Oh, it's great to have you with us. This is Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, last week we spoke with John Dixon about his upcoming book, well, in 2015, A Doubter's Guide to the Bible. We talked about creation, the story of the fall, and how that explains a lot of what we see around us on a daily basis. If you want to catch up on that podcast, you can listen online at publicchristianity.org.
This week, John's going to take us through that formidable chunk of the Bible that Christians call the Old Testament. The subtitle of his book is Inside History's Bestseller for Believers and Skeptics. So this is a no previous knowledge required introduction to reading this very old and very popular book. Welcome, John.
Thanks for having me.
John, the Old Testament often gets a bit of a bad rap with all its laws and all its wars as well. It's big and it's quite foreign and it can be pretty daunting. Why do you think this part of the Bible is worth reading? Why not just, you know, skip to the Jesus bit? That seems a bit friendlier.
It sets up all the foundations for what comes. And Jesus himself said, everything in the first bit, the Old Testament, points to me. And so anyone who's interested in Jesus is committed to understanding the Old Testament. It's simple. But we already saw, you know, last time we talked, how the goodness of creation and the fallenness of creation set up the whole narrative that's coming. And the Old Testament lays that out in great detail. And the New Testament picks up that ball and runs with it. But it's all set up by the brilliant work of the Old Testament.
Sometimes people talk about the Old Testament and the New Testament in a kind of schizophrenic way, as if the Old Testament is the problem and then the New Testament is the solution to that problem. Now, your book's working hard to overcome that perception, isn't it, and show how the two fit together.
Yes, I am working hard to overthrow that perception because it just ain't true. And only the weirdest types of Christians in church history ever thought that.
There were a few of those, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, there have been plenty of weird Christians. But in the second century, there were a group called the Marcionites, and they hated the Old Testament. In fact, they thought the Old Testament God was a rogue and, you know, thank God, the true God for the New Testament God. But most Christians just said, that's nuts. I mean, just look at Jesus. He loved his Old Testament and said, we've got to read it in order to understand him. So I go with Jesus instead of Marcion.
Can you give us a bit of an overview, John? One of the daunting things about the Old Testament is that it's got lots of different kinds of books and lots of different kinds of writing. What are all those? How do they fit together?
Well, that's one of the great things about the Bible. There are so many different literary genres in this book, and it's a great testament, really, to the kind of God Christians have always believed in. He's into literature, different kinds of literature. There are laws, absolutely, because laws are fantastic. Imagine society without them. But there's also poetry. And I know I'm speaking to a poet. There's tons of poetry in the Bible, and God loves poetry. He loves law. He loves poetry. There's historical narrative. History is fantastic. You know, it's the best subject in the world. And the Bible's got tons of it. And then there's this literature called the wisdom literature, which is, you know, sort of reflecting on the brutal and beautiful realities of life and how we might make sense of it. And then there's prophecy, which is looking at current events and then the prophets speaking about what God will do to bring us out of the mess. So all of this forms the Bible, and you have to read each part of the Bible differently. And part of the problem with modern readers is we think the Bible must be a simplistic document, and you read it in all this, all of it in the same way. But the reality is the Bible is way more sophisticated than most modern types of literature, because partly because it's ancient, partly because it's written over so many centuries, so there's a big wisdom build-up in the Bible, and partly because it's a library of books. It's not just one book. Like, you might pick up a novel, you know you're reading a novel. You might pick up the newspaper, you know you're reading the newspaper. The Bible is a library of different books and therefore different literary styles.
Now, John, the pages of the Old Testament are full of these larger-than-life, although, let's be honest, usually deeply flawed characters. Your book looks at figures like Abraham, Moses, Joshua, King David. They're familiar names and important ones. But let's think about the first of these figures, Abraham. Why is he so important if you want to understand the Bible as a whole?
The way Genesis casts the figure of Abraham is that he is, on the one hand, the answer to all the dreadful fall of humanity in the first part of Genesis, and the father of all that comes next. So Abraham, or he's called Abram, and then he's granted the name Abraham, which has this sense of he's going to be the father of a new thing God is doing. He is chosen by God as a pagan, that is, someone who doesn't worship one God, who has multiple gods. God just appears to him and says, you know what, I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to make you into a great community, and I'm going to bless you with my blessing as the creator of the world. And Abraham says, yeah, okay, great, I'll have a part in this. And what's interesting is that the word bless in the call of Abraham, just in one little paragraph, the word bless appears five times. And a lot of scholars think that it's a deliberate counterpoint to the five uses of the word curse in the chapters leading up to Abraham. There are five instances of the word curse in Genesis 1 to 11. And then in the first paragraph of chapter 12, where Abraham's called, five uses the word blessing. And the point is, Abraham resolves the curse of the world. And the way this is so is that he is the recipient of the promise from God that the creation itself will be restored. He gets land. That the social fabric, the human relationships, in other words, will be restored because he's going to become a great nation or community. And the relationship with God is going to be repaired. He's the recipient now of relationship with God. And so this sets up the pattern for the rest of the Bible, that what God is into is restoring the physical, the social, and the spiritual. Not just the spiritual. The Bible is not just a spiritual book about having wisdom and knowing God. It's about creation itself being restored, our human relationships being restored, and of course our relationship with God.
Yeah, so just on that, what do you think that the promises that God makes to Abraham in this point? Tell us about God and his character.
That he's comprehensive, that his interests are not just the kind of ethereal, spiritual, intellectual things that sometimes people think the church is on about. Church is just into being so heavenly minded you're of no earthly use. But the God of the Old Testament, which is in fact the God of Jesus, wants to restore physical life and creation itself, wants to actually have human beings flourishing in relationships with each other. But all of this in the context of knowing God. There is a spiritual dimension, but the spiritual dimension animates the social and the environmental or physical.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're talking to John Dixon about his upcoming book, A Doubter's Guide to the Bible.
Moving on to Moses, who, thanks to Disney and other films, is probably even more well-known than Abraham, is Moses who gives Israel the Old Testament laws. Now, these take up a fair bit of the Old Testament. They can be a bit baffling, even offensive, as a part of the Bible. What's the point of these laws, and why should they matter to people reading the Bible today?
Well, the most important thing to remember about the laws, and about Moses, in fact, is that it's all premised on God's great rescue mission of his people. So after Abraham, the Israelites do, in fact, become a great community, a great nation, but they're a slave people in Egypt for centuries. And brutally mistreated. And Moses is called to lead Israel out of Egypt, out of Egyptian slavery. So the first thing he does is not give them law. The first thing he does is saves them. So he leads them out. And once they're saved, they're rescued as a nation out of tyranny, then they're given laws. And this is a very important insight into the very structure of both the Old and the New Testament. That God's mercy and salvation precede the expectation that you obey him. He has mercy on you and then says, now, you know, I'm the merciful God, follow what I've given you. And so the laws are premised on grace, is the way I try and put it in my book. And this is so clear throughout all of the Old Testament laws, because the very introduction to the laws, people know of the Ten Commandments, the very introduction to the Ten Commandments, which are like the first laws given, says, I am the Lord your God who rescued you from Egypt. therefore have no other gods before me. And then the laws come. So we're reminded that salvation first, obedience second. But even still, the laws are about both spiritual relationship and the social relationship and even the physical relationship to the earth. So if you read through those Old Testament laws, not only are they a response to God's mercy, they are about the three things promised to Abraham. They're about good living in the land, you know, the physical creation. They're about excellent community, doing justice to the poor and so on. And they're about knowing God and when you fall, how to be reconciled with God. And built into the laws of Moses is this constant reminder that you can be forgiven when you break these laws. And so part of the laws are in fact the sacrificial system that would then become part of Israel in the temple. When they build a temple, they'd have a sacrificial system, which is all about how you have a restored conscience when you've defied God.
Let's talk about the book of Joshua. You address this in your book. It's a particularly sensitive issue at the moment when we think about this issue of holy war or religious violence. Atheists like Richard Dawkins write particularly scathingly about this part of the Bible. And it's a tricky area, right? So how can you even begin to defend these stories of war in your book?
Well, I don't think I do defend them. I admit that I find them incredibly troubling. And I remember when my kids were young and I'd come across certain bits of the book of Joshua, you know, turn the page quick. and I do remember my Joshua asking me as we were reading the book of Joshua about why God did that stuff. And, you know, it's a difficult thing. There are a few things just to hold in mind, though, and I don't think these resolve all the problems. But one is that it's fascinating that the Old Testament is adamant that the holy war against the land of Canaan was not to be repeated outside the borders of Canaan. So they weren't meant to go and attack Egypt. They weren't meant to go up to Syria and attack them. It was very limited and over a certain people group. Why? Well, the Old Testament itself says that God was just using his own sinful people, Israel, and he describes them as profoundly sinful, in order to bring judgment on a particular group of people that had wickedness and injustice had risen to the point that God would not stand for them anymore. Now, I still shudder at that as I say it, but it's important to understand the Old Testament doesn't think this is the norm. This is how God's people are to act in the world. It was a particular judgment on a terrible people, and God used his own sinful people in order to do it. And Christians ever since have not interpreted this as anything to do with how we engage with the world. Jesus completely shunned violence. He told us to love our enemies and so on. But Christians have read the story of Joshua and the profound, you know, violence that goes on there as a picture of the final judgment. The vengeance that we see in the book of Joshua is actually a picture, if you like, of the fact that vengeance belongs to the Lord. It is not in the hands of God's people.
One of the things you've touched on there, and really one of the most striking things about the Old Testament, is that, in your words, the Old Testament writers almost delight in telling you how sinful their nation is and how sinful their heroes and kings are. So instead of writing histories that glorify them as a nation, they talk about their failures a lot. What's with that?
Yeah, and it is one of the striking things if you read any other history. If you've read a little bit of Egyptian history or Babylonian, certainly Greek and Roman, and then you read the Old Testament, you think, these guys are so down on themselves, you know? They don't do what other nations do and glorify themselves at every point. They actually make their heroes look like rat bags. And this is true of Moses. It's true of King David, who was the greatest of Israel's kings. But two chapters are given over to how he committed adultery and then murdered someone in order to have this woman. And the Old Testament is just frank about the fact that we are all fallen and in need of God's grace.
So, John, the Old Testament looks forward to the fulfillment of God's promises. Can you give us a sneak peek of next week when we're going to look at the direction that these varied and sometimes strange books are pointing?
A massive part of the Old Testament is the prophets. And the prophets speak to a fallen Israel in all their rottenness and says, one day, a true king is going to come. He's not going to be like David, as good as David was. He's going to be completely righteous. He's going to resolve the problem of the fallenness of Israel and the world. And the New Testament says, we've found that promised king.
Well, we'll look forward to that next week. That's The Doubter's Guide to the Bible. We're talking with John Dixon. Great to have you in, John.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time on Life and Faith.